Good afternoon. This is Michael Edward Miller for WTC. And today, WTC's summer reading series kicks off with a conversation with the author of a new satirical novel about trend forecasting, technology, and intimacy. I'm speaking with Courtney Maugham about her new novel, Touch. You may know her from her first novel, I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You. She's also written a chapbook. Her short fiction, book reviews, and essays have been published in the New York Times. She lives in Connecticut, and she's worked as a trend forecaster, a fashion publicist, and currently a product namer for MAC Cosmetics. Her new novel, Touch, just came out. The protagonist of this story, Sloane Jacobson, is a very famous trend forecaster. Sloane is an American who lives in Paris, and as the story begins, Sloane moves to New York City for a new job. A technology company called Mammoth hires her to predict the next trends in technology. But the problem is, while Sloane is working for Mammoth, she begins to feel that the next tech trend is actually going to be touch, that is, a return to real face-to-face interaction and contact. Of course, Sloane can't admit this. I mean, saying that would probably get her fired or maybe even sued. So she's keeping her prediction secret. She's starting to doubt her own instincts, and she's questioning her own life and values. The setting of the novel Touch is the near future, a world where driverless cars and artificial intelligence are more advanced. Here's Courtney Maugham, the author, speaking at Starline Books, describing the novel's plot a little more.
I mean, the irony is that she's paid to look into connections, but she's disconnected herself. She's estranged from her family, who she hasn't really been with in 15 years. Her love life is a total dumpster fire. She doesn't have a lot of personal friends. And in fact, for most of the book, her closest friend is her driverless car.
I had a chance to speak with Courtney Maugham about her new novel, Touch. We spoke in the downstairs section of Starline Books in Chattanooga.
The novel Touch, where did this basic idea come from? You wanted to write a novel about how technology is making us both more connected and a lot more disconnected at the same time.
The real seed that was planted for this book was about 3 years ago. I started noticing in my circle of friends that people seemed incapable of coming to a decision without the aid of their phone. And that didn't used to be the case.
Yeah.
You know, we used to be able to have a conversation about what to eat and what we wanted to eat and where to eat it without people picking up their devices and, you know, checking, just consulting their phone as to what their phone's algorithms thought that they should eat and where they should eat it and what total strangers thought of that restaurant and the people that had checked into the restaurant, you know, virtually and whatnot. And it carried over also into sort of dating. My friends who were single, you know, I noticed that we would have these exchanges in bars where, you know, we were in a bar, so surrounded by people and new people and not necessarily people you wanted to date, but maybe you meet people and they know someone who's right for
yeah.
you. And instead we'd be staring into my friend's phone and she'd be showing me who her phone thought she should date.
Right.
And whether she agreed with her phone or not. So because I used to work in trend forecasting, intuition and instinct is something that I really cherish and think a lot about. And so I started to wonder, well, is it possible that human instinct could go extinct? You know, is it actually endangered right now? So Touch was my effort to explore that.
It's not billed as sci-fi, but I think
no.
the car in particular is one of those things that we're probably not close to having yet, because it's not just a driverless car. It's
right.
an artificial intelligence that's
yeah.
on basically a human level.
It has full artificial intelligence. It has biometrics, you know, woven is not the right word, but sort of retrofitted throughout the car. But you're absolutely right. It has AI. And I think we're quite close to having driverless cars, but the emotive piece is sort of the holy grail of technology. It's the thing they haven't quite nailed, you know, that they're working on very hard with devices like the Alexa. How can you get a virtual personal assistant to actually be a friend?
Yeah.
So in this book, it you know, it's ironic, of course, that her closest companion is a piece of technology, but it makes sense because Sloan is a busy woman and she's contractually obligated to spend time in that car. She has to be seen in it. So she's in it all the time, and it has these thermal sensors in the seats. And so the car's name is Anastasia, and Anastasia knows when she's stressed. It can sense when her voice, it basically has a lie detector, so it can sense when she's talking about something in a disingenuous manner, can tell if she's dehydrated. So the car really takes care of her because it has the technology to make her coffee or give her water, or it has massaging seat backs. And I have to tell you, I'm on a 2-week tour and I would give anything to have that car. I mean, it's exactly what I need.
That's author Courtney Maugham sitting with me at Starline Books talking about her novel Touch. While she was there, she read an excerpt to the crowd, and let's listen to that right now.
Out on the street, Sloan contemplated her options. It was a beautiful day, cool, crisp, electric, with the promise of things that could go wrong or right. It was rare, a balmy day like this in mid-November, and Sloan wanted to walk to Mammoth's headquarters in Union Square. But she imagined it would be bad form if she didn't show up for her first day of work in the company-sponsored driverless car. So she swiped left on the M-Car app that would summon her chariot from wherever it was that Anastasia recharged. Sloan liked to imagine the car in a set of imperial stables with gloved stable hands and chandeliers, the peaty scent of draft horses warming the cold air. Upscale stable or commonplace garage, it was somewhere close, that much was for certain. Anastasia came purring around the corner in 2 minutes flat. "Good morning, Miss Jacobson," Anastasia chirped once she got in. "Coffee? I have wonderful milk. Or have you already had caffeine?" Sloan looked gratefully at the coffee machine retrofitted into the seat divider. What she would sacrifice in terms of health benefits from not walking to work would be gained by not having to frequent the sadomasochistic espresso joints where the employees acted more like glass blowers than baristas. She didn't have to tell Anastasia how she took it. Her driver had been apprised of her beverage persuasions, and the coffee emerged filled 1/4 of the way up so that she could make it light and sweet. Sloan wasn't a latte girl, or rather, she had been until she moved to Paris. Tourists wax poetic about the quality of that city's espresso, but rarely will you hear someone applaud a French waiter's way with milk. "To the office, then?" Sloan was thankful for the hesitancy in Anastasia's voice. She wanted to believe in a world where all her choices hadn't been made yet, where she could say no, she'd much prefer a winter picnic on Coney Island, or demand that Anastasia head northward for an unplanned getaway to Cape Cod. Spontaneity went hand in hand with longevity. This was something her father had taught her, he who was enigmatic to perfection, encrypted to a fault. A lot of good it did him, though, being surprising. "How are you settling in, Miss Jacobson? How is the apartment?" "You can call me Sloan," Sloan said, draping a linen napkin across her chest in case the car's lighter technology caused them to halt in front of a pothole. "But the apartment's beautiful," she continued, worried she'd been brusque. "It's just what I wanted. I lived here in college." "Well, it must feel very good to be back then," Anastasia replied. "Do you have family here?" Sloan winced. Anastasia had been given enough of her file to know how she liked her coffee, but not enough to know that Sloan was something of a dropout Jacobson. Not that this is something that would have been in her resume. She never talked about her dad's accident when people asked her why she lived in Paris, not even with her friends. At any rate, in her tax bracket, it was assumed she'd have a professional to discuss such intimate problems with. It's incredible how much people want to believe you when you say something's fine. "My family's in Connecticut," Sloan answered, "so not far from here." "Oh," Anastasia said, softer. "You've changed your tone of voice." "I'm sorry," Sloan balked, both astonished and deep inside her, touched that her car's speech recognition engine had been calibrated to pick up on such nuances in tone. "Your voice went down half an octave," Anastasia offered. "But we don't have to address that. I have been told by numerous sources that the holidays are a trying time of year." And I'll stop there. I think it gives you a little bit of an idea.
That's author Courtney Maugham reading an excerpt of her new novel, Touch. In many ways, it's a story about intimacy. Sloane, the protagonist, is a trend forecaster. Her recent forecasts are kind of grim. She's saying the world is overpopulated, and with unemployment, college costs rising, and food prices rising as well, having children is just an extravagant indulgence at this point. Tech giant Mammoth hires Sloane to lead their groundbreaking annual conference celebrating the voluntarily childless, but not far into her contract, Sloane begins to sense the undeniable signs of a movement against electronics that's going to see people embracing compassion, empathy, and in-personism again. She's struggling with the fact that her predictions are hopelessly out of sync with her employer's mission. Also, her closest personal relationship is with the self-driving car Anastasia that we just heard about. Also, her love life is not going so well. Her partner is a French neo-essentialist named Roman, who publishes an op-ed in the New York Times basically saying real in-person sex is something that he's no longer interested in, not even with her. Here's more of my conversation with Courtney Maugham. And just a note, we were speaking in the downstairs part of Starline Books. Throughout the conversation, you'll hear floors creaking and footsteps overhead. While I was talking to her, more and more people were gathering upstairs for her book signing.
The character of her boyfriend in the novel, Roman, yeah. He wears this skin-tight suit that covers everything, not just his body, but his face, his eyes,
everything,
his mouth.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize these are real. What
oh,
are these
yeah,
things?
They're real. So they're called Zentai suits with a Z for those of you who want to make the possible mistake of Googling them. And they started off as Japanese fetish wear. But now it's true there's a whole subcultures of people who wear them as a lifestyle thing. And you know, there's these pictures of people making omelets in their Zentai suit. There's a whole movement of people who go out into the woods in them. And Roman's stance on the Zentai suit in the book is he considers himself a neo-sensualist. So he lectures on sensuality in the digital age. And he is of the belief that sex isn't necessary anymore, that the world is overpopulated enough, and virtual sexuality offers, you know, all that and more.
Yeah.
And so he's very interested in touch and tactility. And so the Zentai suit is fascinating to him because you can see him, you can see that he's a person, but you cannot access his skin. I mean, you really can't. There's no opening.
And he's kind of famous. He writes this article, essay for the New York Times about exactly that, about how he doesn't think sex is necessary anymore, which, of course, enrages the protagonist, his girlfriend.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and he announces publicly, instead of to her, that he's never going to have sex with her again, or anyone else.
Yeah.
News to her. I mean, she had to read it in the paper.
Do you think, I mean, it seems like when I read that, I thought, this is maybe just a guy who's addicted to porn and trying to justify it by sounding really intellectual.
But he's actually not, I mean, well, all right, let me game that out. Maybe he is. I mean, I hadn't actually thought about it because he thinks about human interaction in such a clinical way that it's true I hadn't thought of him as being someone addicted to porn. But there's a quote in the book that it's actually by a real journalist about how people can actually date their computers now, and how some people truly do get addicted to watching porn, but they can't actually have physical, you know, I don't know, comminglings with real people. They truly get addicted to the experience
it's
at the computer.
Your brain chemistry works,
and that's John Mayer. He's admitted.
Really?
He's addicted. He's come out as a porn addict.
Did not know that.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it seems like that, and just more generally, the idea of electronics addiction, not just, I play with my phone, but real, honest to God, you need treatment addiction, I think probably will be the next really big thing.
Well, you know, it has been for many, many years in Asia. There are cell phone addiction camps, and there have been since, 2005, especially in Korea and Japan. In the book, one of the predictions, there's a bunch of predictions in the book, and this one's fictional at the time at which we're having this interview. I don't know if it'll come to pass, but Sloan talks about people in Japan who are walking around with straitjackets to keep their hands off of their devices, and it signals to other people that they're going through a cleanse, a digital detox. And instead of being ridiculous, it's supposed to empower other people to detox from their devices. Yeah.
And I think right now we, at least in America, still just don't take it that seriously. We just think, well, just put down your dang phone.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to say that this book is so serious about technology.
You know, no, it's really
there's
funny.
There's a pro-technology side to the book, so you can choose your own camp. The book, it's not, I don't want people to think that it's a book that's going to judge people about their use of technology. It's simply meant to inspire people to kind of reclaim their independence from their devices and so that they can use them as a tool again and not like a drug. You know, because technology's great. It's great. My family, my husband's French, so you know, using FaceTime every weekend to call his parents, and we have our little toddler who can see her grandparents that way. It's really special. You know, so it can be very, very connected. It just can't be. You know, you shouldn't overuse. Remember to read books from time to time and look people in the eyes.
The novel, it's really funny. It's satire. Tell me about your sense of humor, where it comes from, who some of your influences are.
My sense of humor was probably cultivated by having kind of a crazy family. You might be able to hear them upstairs because they're starting to arrive at my event at Starline. But just you have funny characters in my family. And I think when I was younger, it was a bit of a coping device as, you know, things went awry a little bit. My parents got divorced. My brother had really bad health problems growing up. So humor was definitely a little bit of a coping device. And then in terms of influences, I love Martin Amis, British writer. I quite like Jonathan Franzen. He's not always super funny, but he's very entertaining. Jim Shepherd is a hero to me. He can make you laugh out loud and then weep, but not even in the same paragraph, but like in the same sentence. And then A.M. Holmes, female writer from L.A., she's just hysterical. I mean, I could go on and on. There's a lot of, but those were kind of the first writers I read who I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't know that you could have humorous literary fiction. I didn't really give myself permission into, because when I was a younger writer, I was always reading The New Yorker and literary magazines, and the stories tend to be pretty dark. And I thought that's what you had to write to get published. Yeah. So it took me a while to discover the Gary Steingarts of the world and the Joshua Ferrises. And
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on staying alert and awake because I'm still on book tour, and my publisher's been very good to me, so they've got me on like two cities a day for 2 weeks. So, but I, for the past couple of months, I'm trying to work on an adaptation of a chapbook I have. Chapbooks are tiny little books, and I have a chapbook called Notes from Mexico with a place called The Cupboard Pamphlet. And it's just a very weird kind of experimental story that takes place in Western Mexico. And so I spent a lot of the winter in Mexico. But I really don't have it yet. I don't know. I'm tempted to try another experimental voice like that chapbook was. But I've been writing in the vein of my two books now for a while. And it's actually hard to get back to a different tone.
Huh.
It's really hard, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's like if you're quite good at music and you've been playing one instrument for a while, maybe you used to play classical guitar and you've been playing the piano for a long time, and then you try to go back to the classical. You know, it's going to take some practice.
Right.
So oddly, I'm just doing a lot of sketching, but with words, and just trying to find my way back into whatever tone of voice is going to be right for this tale. And I might try to do something with multiple narrators, which is something I've never ever done, and so I'm scared of it, and I have to teach myself how to do it. It's not coming very naturally to me.
Oh wow.
So we'll see.
But the novel is told primarily through Sloane's point of view, but it's not first person. I thought that was an interesting decision.
Yeah, it's close third, which is very, very hard for me. But it had to be close third. It couldn't be first person because you'd be too much in her head, and I needed to sometimes pull the camera out and see the larger worlds because, you know, she's talking about trends within the world. But my first book's very much in first person, and that's I'm the most comfortable in that register. It's the most fun for me. I love writing from the point of view of men. So this book was actually really hard. I know that sounds weird because I'm a woman, but it was really hard.
If you're just tuning in, that's author Courtney Maugham. We're talking about her new novel, Touch. This is the first in WTC's series of summer readings interviews. This conversation was recorded downstairs at Starline Books in Chattanooga.
Just her character in general. So she's a trend forecaster, and that's like a very specific thing. There's trend forecasters, there's trend makers. Well, what specifically does a trend forecaster do?
Right. No, I'm glad you brought that up because there is a big difference between what we think of as influencers who, you know, that's someone like a Gwyneth Paltrow or a Selena Gomez, usually celebrities or models who, you know, people want to try to follow their style and their lifestyle. Then you have trend spotters who are often attached to magazines and they're paid to kind of go around the world and just see what the trends are, but what's already happening. And then trend forecasters think very far out, 5 to 20 years in the future, about things that haven't even happened yet. So you need a lot of intuition and confidence to be a trend forecaster.
If you're somebody who's doing that for a living, you're looking at what's going to happen 5 or however many years ahead. I mean, companies, how do they know if you're any good or not?
Well, you know, you need a little time. Yeah, time has to pass. I mean, there's shorter-term trend forecasting for sure. A lot of the trend forecasters give either seasonal, usually seasonal, sometimes annual presentations where they'll announce the reigning color or catchword for the season ahead. So I guess probably the world's most famous trend forecaster right now is a woman named Lee Edelcourt. She's Danish. And so she gives these presentations 4 times a year at the change of every season. And they're very expensive to attend. Her company puts out trend books that are, you know, they're like $5,000 to purchase. And she'll make these huge pronouncements like gray, everything's going to be gray. And if you go to these presentations, you'll be served gray food. You know, so they're very arty intellectual affairs. But she had 1 year where she pronounced, you know, altruism was the big trend. This year, I think she's announced that it's portraiture, which is a fancy way of saying selfie.
Wow, I thought that was kind of done already.
Me too. So I just found this out because I didn't pay to go to her presentation, but I had I work for MAC Cosmetics, naming products, and I had a friend there who went, and so she told me that this was the pronouncement, and I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
I do think that that's behind us. In fact, I think we must be moving away from selfies because there's just been too many of them. So, but again, I wasn't there, so maybe it was something more complicated than that. It might be more complicated. Maybe my friend misinterpreted it, because that doesn't sound very Lee Edelcourt.
Or maybe they're going to, I don't know, come up with a different name for it.
Yeah, something like that.
Trend forecasting, how accurate do you think it is in general?
You know, the thing is people always find a way to make it accurate, right? A lot of trend forecasters, like I said with Lee Edelcourt, when she predicted that altruism would be the reigning catchword of, I think it was 2011, I mean, it's pretty easy to find examples that point to altruism being a trend, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes harder when you predict very niche, small trends, right? Like, I worked for a company a couple of years ago, and I'm in no way saying that I'm better than Lee Edelcourt. I absolutely am not. It just so happens that, you know, I was a consultant, so I was actually hired to pick out very small trends. And so something I predicted, a couple years ago that would hit around now is prepare yourself. Ear makeup. So I'm not talking like, oh, your ears flush and they turn red and you need to. I'm talking about people decorating their earlobes with sort of brighter colors or gold. You know, they do a little line. So it's not a full-blown thing yet, but it hit the runways for resorts, and I think we'll start to see it. I did some for my New York launch, and I forgot to take a picture, and I want to beat myself up now, but it's really pretty. I know, usually people do it with gold or silver, just a little highlights, you know, it almost looks like jewelry. It's really pretty.
And one of the things in the novel, you suggest that maybe she's just a little bit psychic, and that's...
Yeah. Well, I think most trend forecasters have an element of that. Your intuitions have to be so strong, they're a little eerie. You have to be tapped into frequencies that other people aren't. But, you know, I mean, this is certainly it's a talent, but everyone has their talent. I mean, super athletes have a talent.
Yeah.
Musicians have an ear that's attuned. So I think trend forecasters have an intuition that's highly, highly developed.
Is there anything else I haven't asked you?
Whether I have a website. I'm very proud that my husband made me one.
Yes.
I do have one. It's CourtneyMaum.com. Mom is spelled M-A-U-M. And I have all my tour dates and articles I've written and short stories and stuff, so you can find out more there if you'd like to.
Oh, and you speaking of France, you lived there for a while promoting Corona.
I know,
What was that job?
Yeah, so I was a party promoter for Corona Extra, and the only reason I got that, I desperately needed a work visa. And in order to get a work visa in France, you have to prove that there's a reason. It has to be an American doing the job and not someone from the EU.
Yeah.
And they really wanted an American, because even though it's not American beer, it has a very, you know, it's an American culture thing about mm-hmm. it. And I found out about that job because a friend of a friend used to have it. And he brought me to a party, and I asked him, like, how did you get this job? He was driving around in a Corona mobile, and he said, oh, do you want it? I'm leaving in 5 days for med school. And the job was just given to me. So I drove around, mostly Paris, but all of France, trying to sell Corona and throwing Corona parties for 3 years.
I mean, was your real clients, was it like distributors and bar owners, or was it more just...
It was bar and nightclub owners. And then we had a whole portfolio of other spirits and beer. So like Tequila Herradura, which now I would give anything to work for Tequila Herradura. But because of them, that's a high-priced tequila. So I was able to go to kind of the five-star hotels. So, you know, I did some proper salesmanship. It wasn't just... you know, Corona parties all the time, but that Corona was our most successful brand with the biggest budget. So yeah, I had a Corona mobile. It was...
What was that like? what was work? If you've ever heard This American Life.
Yeah, example, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. They did a really good one on a guy whose job was being a beer promoter and how he just got burned out. And,
yeah. It's exhausting. I mean, I usually didn't work till 4 or 5, you know, when the bars start to open, and then I'd have pretty late nights, and I'd be throwing parties till very late. So it was really fun. I mean, for a writer, it was great, because I would write during the day. I wrote my first novel during the days when I wasn't selling beer, and then I would go out and sell beer, so it felt like celebrating this good writing day. So it was a wonderful gig, and they were very kind to me. I was the only foreigner, I was the only woman, I was the youngest person, so I felt I had all these big brothers, you know, who really took care of me, and... It was great, and my French became fantastic because I had to work with, you know, I had to hold my own against these misogynistic restaurant owners. They were all men. So it was a very good, it was a confidence-boosting thing for me.
Is that how you met your husband?
No, but he was very happy when he met me to know that my car was filled with booze and beer at all times, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I imagine that would be...
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you're also on Twitter. What is your handle?
C Mom, C-M-A-U-M. And I'm on Instagram, C-B Mom.
Once again, that was author Courtney Maum. Her new novel is Touch. You can find it at Starline Books in Chattanooga. That's also where we recorded the interview.